You may be seated. Our next case is 14-451, Jerry Dillon and Nancy Dillon versus the Farmers Insurance of Columbus, Incorporated. For the appellant, Mr. Glassman.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. This case is not about the public policy or the legality of the use of aftermarket parts in vehicle repairs. This has already been addressed and approved by the legislature. So the safety concerns expressed by the appellees and the amicus parties in their briefs don't need to be considered by the court today. This is not a safety issue. This is a freedom of contract issue and a freedom of choice issue. Unlike most of the insurance disputes this court deals with, this case also doesn't involve the interpretation of insurance policies or the legality of policy language, because even the Court of Appeals acknowledged the policy language on the use of aftermarket parts was proper. Unlike other insurance claims you deal with, this is also not about improprieties or disagreements with the claims process. Because
So what is it about? You've told us other things it's not about. Tell us what you think it is about.
Yes, Your Honor. This case is about one sentence of 1345-81, which was taken out of context by the Court of Appeals, and that one sentence is when the Court of Appeals imposed the signature requirement in the claims process for the estimate. That's what this case is about.
Is there a signature requirement?
Based upon the facts that we have, there is not. The estimate was conveyed to Mr. Dillon in two different forms. Initially, there was an oral estimate given to him by Mr. Babb, the claims representative. In the oral estimate, Mr. Babb also advised Mr. Dillon that the estimate was derived based upon the use of aftermarket parts as a policy allows for. In that conversation, Mr. Dillon advised Mr. Babb he disagreed with the use of aftermarket parts and was not going to go along with it and was going to insist the repair shop that he selected use OEM parts. Thereafter, Mr. Babb sent the estimate to Mr. Dillon. He mailed to the Dillon's home, and that estimate was never signed. The signature requirement doesn't apply here either under B1, which applies to written estimates, or B2, which applies to oral estimates. Because when you look at B1 at the very last sentence, it requires receipt and approval of the written estimate be acknowledged by signature. Here we have a situation where the customer was never going to approve the estimate, and he told the adjuster even before the written estimate was issued, I don't agree with your estimate, I'm going to do this my way, which he's allowed to do. But it doesn't increase the insurance company's obligation to him. So we have a situation here where there was no way Mr. Dillon could ever be forced to sign the estimate, because clearly he wasn't going to sign an estimate he was never going to approve.
Has that case arisen before this one, or is this first impression for this court?
This is a case of first impression for this court, Your Honor.
Okay. So when a consumer or when a victim of an auto accident receives an estimate that he or she doesn't agree with, what does that person do?
If it's a case like here, the only disagreement was whether or not aftermarket parts were going to be used on the vehicle. The policy allows for aftermarket parts to be used.
Maybe I ask the question a different way. Does the statute provide that if someone doesn't agree with an insurance estimate for repair, the person has some recourse?
Are you talking about in the context of aftermarket parts, or if there's a disagreement
on
a different issue?
Of the signature requirement.
I'm sorry, I talked over you. I didn't catch the last part of your question.
If an individual receives an estimate that they don't agree with, does the statute provide some remedy for that person vis-a-vis the signature requirement of the statute?
The statute here only deals with the issue of aftermarket parts. So if we're dealing with a situation where the disagreement is something other than aftermarket parts, you look to the policy and you look to the other remedies available under Chapter 39. If the disagreement is over the use of aftermarket parts, then the remedy for the consumer is the insurance company only has to pay what the insurance company policy requires. However, there's still a remedy, which is Ohio recognizes a claim for diminution in value of a vehicle, and the customer can make the claim to the insurer that I've now had my vehicle repaired with aftermarket parts. Even though the repairs were done properly and they were done correctly, my vehicle is still worth less than it was at the time of the accident. I'm entitled to recover the difference, and that's a recognized claim.
And that was not done?
Correct. There were a number, in the original complaint that was filed, I believe, had seven causes of action, some under statutory theories, some under common law theories. All the claims were voluntarily dismissed by the plaintiffs with the exception of the Consumer Sales Practices Act claim. So there was never a claim presented here for diminished value to the vehicle. And in Mr. Dillon's deposition, he testified the reason OEM parts were so important to him weren't because of any safety concerns, but because I'm afraid how this might affect the value of my vehicle. But then he never went on to make the claim. Instead, he chose to have OEM parts used in the repair process.
And that's what were used.
Correct. The policy, the insurance policy, does not provide for an upgrade. Going from aftermarket parts to OEM parts is an upgrade.
So the insurance will pay up to a certain portion, and then if the customer insists on original manufactured parts, then they will pay the difference? Is that the theory?
That's correct, because what we're dealing with here, again, is an upgrade from what the policy requires. And the purpose of the statute is full disclosure to the consumer, which we have here. If you look at, this is in the appendices to both the Appellee's brief, I think to one or more of the amicus briefs, they reference the testimony of Brooke Cheney in 1990 when the legislature adopted Section 81. And Mr. Cheney testified before the legislature, the purpose of this was to simply make certain that consumers make an educated and informed choice about whether they want to use OEM parts or whether they want to use aftermarket parts.
Is there any dispute that the customer wanted original parts?
No.
Okay, and is there any dispute that the insurance company was only going to allow for aftermarket parts?
No, and Mr. Dillon was told that when he was provided with the estimate.
Okay, so then the provision of the estimate, you know, went to him. He never signed it and returned it. He never signed it and wrote, you know, I refuse to accept this. I only, and put it in writing that I only want original equipment, original manufactured equipment.
Correct, because under B2, which governs oral estimates, the initial requirement of B2 is when the oral estimate is given, you can either make the disclosure of the use of aftermarket parts in writing to the policyholder or to the vehicle owner, or you can make the disclosure orally. Here the disclosure clearly was made orally to Mr. Dillon, because Mr. Dillon told the adjuster, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to insist upon OEM. I'm going to have the repairs done at the shop I want with the parts I want.
Okay,
and that's
exactly
what happened.
And that is up to, the insurance company could have agreed to original equipment parts.
They could have, but the policy doesn't require it.
I understand that, but you could have.
Correct.
All right, and then you made it clear it was not going to happen. He was not happy with that. Took it to his shop. Was it Mission Repair, Auto Repair, I think it was, and then had the work done.
Correct, and yeah, he took the vehicle to the shop he wanted and had the repairs done his way. Then the shop, in turn, referred Mr. Dillon to his counsel, indicating they had referred other customers to Mr. Skelton as well to present these types of claims.
Let me take you back to the beginning of your argument. You said there was a flaw in the Fifth District Appellate Court opinion with one line. What are you taking issue with in the appellate opinion?
The only thing the Fifth District said that my client did wrong was not getting the signature of Mr. Dillon. That's the only criticism they have.
And your point then would be, because he didn't agree with the estimate, he was never going to sign it.
Correct. Yeah, the spirit and the letter of the statute was met by disclosure being made. We know disclosure was made because Mr. Dillon chose to go in a different direction. But if you look under B1, it references receipt and approval of the estimate. Here we know there was receipt of the estimate. We know there wasn't approval because Mr. Dillon chose to proceed differently.
Counsel, this almost, maybe this is my overly active imagination, but this
This seems analogous to me to the state trooper who's giving you a ticket and asking you to sign the ticket and tells you, you don't have to agree with this ticket, but you do have to sign it. You know what I'm talking about? Now, it seems to me, I don't think this case is about insurance policies or OEM versus aftermarket. The question is, you got hit with a violation of the Consumer Sales Practices Act, which says there must be a written estimate, correct?
It doesn't require a written estimate. You can either do a written estimate or an oral estimate, and that dictates whether B1 or B2 is implicated, Your Honor.
I thought that the Fifth District Court of Appeals this time said there was no written estimate with a signature of the property owner. Therefore, there's been a violation. Therefore, there's treble damages. Therefore, there's attorney fees. Am I missing something?
What the Fifth District wanted, and maybe we're getting hung up on semantics. What the Fifth District wanted was a signature of a written acknowledgement by Mr. Dillon, but the reality is by the time Mr. Dillon received the written estimate, he had already decided to proceed differently with the use of OEM parts. The disclosure had been fully made
to
him.
I'm reading from the Fifth District right now where it gets rid of the OEM parts. It says it's permissible under the policy, but pursuant to 134581, appellant must have appellee sign the written estimate. Is that why we're here today? You're saying they must not sign it?
I'm saying that there's no way to force somebody to sign an estimate if they're not going to do it. And by the time Mr. Dillon had the written estimate in hand, the repairs had already been started.
Is the record clear that the estimate was tendered?
Yes, it's in Mr. Dillon's deposition that he received an estimate by mail after he told the adjuster he was going to insist upon OEM parts.
So what you're saying today, I think in answer to Justice O'Donnell, is you want this court for the first time to look at, all right, the estimate was given to you, must you sign it? Isn't that what this case is about?
The estimate, no. This case is about, when you look at the signature, first of all, the issue we haven't gotten to yet is whether this statutory scheme even applies to insurers and whether there's a statutory remedy here.
Isn't the larger question whether or not the resolution of an automobile repair estimate is a consumer transaction?
Yes, that is the threshold question. And if the answer to that question is no, then the conversation ends there.
And what is your response to whether it is or isn't?
It is not a consumer transaction.
What's your best argument on that point?
If you look at the definitions in 134501, they spell out what is and is not a consumer transaction, and transactions between insurers and their policyholders are specifically carved out. And that's consistent with the statutory scheme governing insurance companies.
So you want this court to write an opinion that says the process of providing an estimate for the repair of an automobile between a carrier and a claimant is not a consumer transaction.
That is correct.
That's exactly what the statute says, according to you. That's 134501.
Yes, Chapter 39 specifically regulates and governs insurers. The Consumer Sales Practices Act specifically excludes insurers. There are remedies under Chapter 39 if an insurance company doesn't do what they're supposed to do. 134581 creates remedies against body shops and repair shops which didn't exist previously. There are already adequate remedies available to consumers if they have issue with how their claim is being handled.
Yes,
by their
the
insurer.
Tangential issue then is whether or not the carrier is a supplier or whether the body shop is the supplier or if there is a supplier or if that even applies because of your argument under the statute.
The carrier is not a supplier because they're not providing the service. The only thing the estimate is this is what we think the reasonable cost of the repair of the vehicle is. The itemization just simply tells the policyholder this is how we derived the number. What the policyholder does when they have the estimate is completely up to them. Some people, if their car's not damaged too badly, don't even have repairs done. They pocket the money and they move on, and they're allowed to do that.
Let me take you back to the diminution of claim remedy that you referenced earlier in your presentation. Is that a statutory remedy?
No, I don't recall the name, but there was a case from within the last 5 years out of Franklin County, out of the 10th District, which specifically recognized common law cause of action for diminished value, and other districts have adopted that as well.
Okay, thank
you. Looking at 1345.81, I just want to clarify. It seems to suggest that this estimate is at the request of the customer. In this particular case, did the customer ask for a written estimate or not ask for a written estimate? Because B1 says if the person requesting the repair chooses to receive the written estimate, and then B2 says if the person chooses to receive the oral estimate or no estimate at all.
Mr. Dillon did not request a written estimate. In fact, because once he received the oral estimate, he was at the point of disagreement that there were the sequence of this. He got the oral estimate, did not like the oral estimate. The written estimate was sent to him anyway to explain the claims process.
So you went under B2, where you don't have to have a signature because there's an oral estimate. You just sign it. You send the estimate afterwards.
Correct, because you know there are multiple letters that are sent to the policyholder during the claims process, either dealing with the towing, the rental car. In this case, there was additional damage found after the repairs were started. That was paid as well. But if you look at the end of B2, B2 talks about the customer receiving a written notice at the end of the repair process.
Right.
Here, that requirement isn't even triggered, because aftermarket parts were never used in the repair process. So there was no written disclosure for Mr. Dillon to even sign off on at that point.
But doesn't the statute require you to ask if they want a written estimate? That seems to be the suggestion, because you were saying no, or you were going to not use OEM parts, correct?
Yes, Mr.
Okay,
Dillon
you weren't going to pay for that. So. Wasn't the issue whether the customer wanted the written estimate or not, as to whether there had to be a signature on a signed estimate?
If you look at B1, in the first sentence of B1, B1 specifically requires the customer to choose to receive a written estimate, and if they don't make that choice, then that requirement is not triggered.
So who tells the customer you have the choice of the written or an oral estimate?
That would have been something that would have been discussed in the phone call between Mr. Babb and Mr. Dillon as far as how the claims process was going to be handled.
And that was done here?
I don't think, in all honesty, either deposition gives you a very good blow-by-blow of the conversation between the two men.
Counsel, you've used your time.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Chris Hoff, and I represent the Amicus Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, an association of 12 major vehicle manufacturers accounting for more than 3/4 of the car and light truck sales in the United States. I'd like to take 4 or 5 minutes today to discuss the safety concerns involving the use of imitation vehicle parts and to briefly address the impact of such use on vehicle lease agreements.
Is that issue before us, counsel?
It's not directly before you, but these type of concerns underscore the importance of the disclosure requirements in 1345.81, and they are the type of concerns that motivated the legislature 25 years ago to enact this statute.
So you can't speak to that question I had at the very end with respect to who tells the customer there's a choice between getting a written and an oral estimate?
I believe the implication in the statute is that there would be a discussion with a representative of the insurance company, and that the consumer would then have the opportunity to make such an election. And I don't believe that there's any indication in the record that that conversation ever took place in this case.
But there was actually both were done in this case. There was an oral discussion, and there was the discussion that we're going to use aftermarket parts. And then there was also the proffer of the written estimate with the language estimate received by, and then that was where the signature of the consumer would have gone, correct?
The only way that the Dillons found out in this case that the insurance company proposed the use of imitation parts was through a discussion with Mission Auto. They did not find that out from Mr. Babb, the farmer's insurance representative.
Is that a point of a dispute here?
I believe that's supported by the record. It appears that Farmers takes a contrary position.
Okay, so it's not, what did the Court of Appeals find, though, with regards to who disclosed to the Dillons that they, you know, had the option?
I'd like to focus on the safety issues that are the primary concern.
Counsel, we know what the policy by the legislature is and the underpinnings to that. That's not why we're here, to advocate whether this is a good policy or not. That's not our role here. We're interested in this specific case and the ramifications it has.
I don't believe that the Court of Appeals found that that Mr. Babb or any other representative of Farmers Insurance provided a written or oral estimate to the Dillons.
They did provide a written estimate.
They provided a written estimate to Mission Auto, and representative Mission Auto then communicated the content of that estimate to the Dillons, but Farmers Insurance or Mr. Babb did not directly communicate that
information. Is that required, that they directly, or that he just receives it?
Well, if there's no requirement that Farmers Insurance provide a written estimate, or any insurance company provide a written or oral estimate to the consumer, notifying them that the insurance company proposes the use of non-original parts, then the only way that the consumer would find out is if the auto body repair facility then communicates that information to them, which...
Well, right. The auto body repair shop is going to say to the customer, you know, it's been my experience that your, Farmers Insurance here, your insurance carrier, is only going to authorize aftermarket parts. That happens all the time, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then the Mission Auto Repair had in its possession, you're saying, this estimate of what Farmers told Mission that they will pay for.
That's correct.
And that was conveyed to Mr. Dillon, you're saying, through Mission?
That's correct, because they had an ongoing relationship.
Right, okay.
The Dillons and Mission had a relationship.
Okay, and then Dillon refused to sign the estimate received by, which is not an acknowledgement of, I agree with this estimate, I'm going to accept the aftermarket parts. This is merely an acknowledgement of a receipt of the actual obligation that the insurance company feels that they have.
But Mr. Dillon never actually received a written estimate. That information was just communicated to him.
He never saw the document.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I'm not positive about that, but I don't believe so. After the fact, he did. It's part of the record here. It's attached to the Dillon's brief.
Well, counsel, that's why I asked the question before. I think it's kind of important. I know you want to talk about OEM parts today, but I want to talk about consumer sales practice, and it was just represented that a written estimate was tendered to this consumer. And are you saying that is not true, or you don't know?
Farmers Insurance, or any representative of Farmers Insurance, did not give the Dillons a written estimate in this case.
And that is required by the Consumer Sales Practice Act, or an oral, correct?
That the consumer be given an option to choose one or the other.
Who gives the estimate, though? Who gives the estimate? The company that's going to repair, or the insurance company?
The insurance company.
Mr. Heff, you want to address the issue of aftermarket parts versus original parts, am I right?
I'd like to briefly address that issue.
I'd like to hear your argument on that, okay. If you would, please.
In short, there are virtually no federal regulations or state regulations governing the manufacturing or use of imitation parts. For instance, the only federal motor vehicle safety standard that applies to any imitation parts are headlamps. The imitation parts are not government crash tested. They're not necessarily made of the same materials as original manufacturer parts. And by contrast, original manufacturer parts are extensively crash tested by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. I'd like to turn the floor over to Mr. Traska to further address your questions on the statutory language. Thank you.
Mr. Traska.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Peter Traska, and it's my privilege to represent the Dillons and two of the AMICHI, the Choice Auto Body Repair Association, and the Automotive Education and Policy Institute. This case is about the plain language of 1345-81, and specifically, to my way of evaluating it, the important phrase is its subsection E, which says that it applies to insurers acting, quote, in connection with a consumer transaction. There is no need analytically to consider.
What's the consumer transaction here?
The car repair.
Between the car owner and the repair shop.
And the shop.
It's not a consumer transaction between the insurance company and the Dillons.
Alternatively, we would say it definitely is, because if we get into whether Farmers is, in this case, acting as a supplier, the record is very clear that they are. One, by dictating how much it will pay and what parts have to be used. Secondly, if you look at pages 8 and 9 of the estimate actually furnished in this case, not only did Farmers say, we're only paying for the imitation parts, they went so far as to say, hey, shop, you can get these parts from this distributor.
Counsel,
that's
not
fair. Did they say you were mandated to get those parts from that distributor?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Were they mandated to get the parts from that distributor?
I'll let the estimate speak for itself on that. I think the reason...
Did they have a warehouse of parts? Does Farmers maintain a warehouse of parts someplace?
I can tell you that this is an issue of sweeping importance in the collision repair industry, which is something that the Amici would really like you to know.
Counsel, it's not really fair when you say that the insurance company is saying you must use aftermarket parts. The reality is, in this case and in all cases, they say we will pay $1,540. That you can get your car fixed for that if you use aftermarket. If you want to use OEM, have a nice day. Isn't that really what they say?
Yes, and that's very fair, and that's an important point. And as I think it was Justice O'Donnell's questioning was getting to the mechanics of how does this work. Under the statute, how this is supposed to work is that whether the estimate is provided in writing or verbally, there are disclosures that have to be made. One thing that doesn't appear in the briefs, you haven't heard it today in oral argument, Farmers makes no mention of the fact that one of those disclosures is that these parts are not going to be warrantied by the manufacturer of your car. They're going to be warrantied by the manufacturer of these parts. I know how to find Ford. I know how to find Chrysler. I don't know how to find the manufacturer of the cheapest part that can be bought. That is a major, major difference. Now, as for whether...
Well, do these parts arrive at the auto repair in a brown paper bag and no return address?
Well, no, Your Honor. And the statute, and forgive me, I forget if it's the statute or the claims regulation, but one of these provides further that the parts are supposed to be stamped with some indication of origin. Now...
there's plenty of original equipment that is manufactured overseas, is it not?
Well, that's true. Plenty also in Ohio. Sure.
Sure.
Yes.
So, you know, the same plant that might be manufacturing your original equipment could very well be manufacturing your aftermarket parts.
If that consideration is important to the court,
then I
would submit, Your Honor, then the consideration of the overall quality. It's difficult to talk about this issue without spilling over into the policy of it. One of the points here on the policy consideration, if you lease a vehicle, significant portion of the market, almost without exception, I have never seen one that doesn't include language saying that, hey, if the vehicle happens to be crashed during the lease period, you have to repair it with OEM parts.
Right.
So one of the purposes of this disclosure statute is to make it very, very clear before any decisions are taken about how this repair is to proceed that there is an issue with OEM parts.
Do you think that should be addressed up front when you're purchasing insurance and you say to Farmers or whomever is your coverage provider that I want a policy that is going to require or is going to pay for original equipment, and I'm willing to pay for that because that's the requirement I have.
Personally, I do not allow my clients to purchase insurance without me. Yes.
Without what?
Without me. One needs the language of an insurance policy has any number of surprises that come out at other times.
Mr. Treska, let me pull you to the issue that's bothering me, and it's whether or not this is a consumer transaction, because if I understood Mr. Glassman's argument, he alleges that 1345-01A excludes transactions between those defined in 5725 and their customers.
Right.
What's your response to that argument?
Generally, it is true that a transaction between a policyholder and an insurance company is not, under the CSPA, a consumer transaction.
Okay. Is there an exception to that?
There is
statute.
Explicitly in the E section of 134581. It is not required for this section of the statute to apply. It is not required for the insurance company to be engaging in a consumer transaction. It is required that they be acting in connection with a consumer transaction. Now, I think it's a thorny issue that could be argued that we'd need a lot more evidence to get, you know, is this the business of insurance? Isn't this the business?
We need to take a look at 134581E and make a determination as to whether or not Farmers Insurance was acting in connection with a consumer transaction between
That's correct.
The repair shop and the customer.
Yes.
When
yes,
would they not be under these circumstances? Every time you have an automobile wreck, if you are going to get it repaired, and I know that there was testimony that some people, the minimal damage and they pocket the insurance proceeds, but whenever you're going to have an interaction between an owner of a damaged vehicle and the repair shop, you're going to have the element of the insurance company communicating with their customer as well as the auto repair shop.
Yes. Interestingly, about maybe 20 years ago, the industry standard was not for the insurance company to be so involved. Claims adjustment 20 years ago ordinarily was the car is wrecked, please get three estimates, we'll, you know, subject to making sure it's done right, we'll go with one of those. Probably the cheapest one of those, but we'll go with one of those. Now, what has changed is that the insurance companies, and this is the conversation we have to have if we get to whether or not they're a supplier, insurance companies, by writing estimates, by the content of what these estimates are, insurance companies leverage shops daily to do the repair according to how they want it done, as opposed to putting the car back into its pre-accident condition. And again, that's a very large issue that is beyond the scope of this case unless we get into whether the insurance company is a supplier.
Counsel, the difficulty, though, that I have with your argument about subsection E, it doesn't just say in connection with a consumer transaction. It's in connection with a consumer transaction as defined in 134501, and that provision specifically excludes insurers. How do we get around that?
Very simply, and again, I would love to hear from Farmers on this issue. The consumer transaction is between the policyholder and the shop,
which is defined as a consumer transaction in 134501.
Unmistakably, and that much is not disputed. So what the statute does is single out a way that insurance companies do get involved, and again, they don't have to. They could go back to the old way of doing business, but they choose to get involved. So the statutes and the regs, and by the way, the Department of Insurance wrote regs referencing this statute. The Department of Insurance certainly thinks that 1345 does apply to insurance companies. But the statute singles out a way that carriers do get involved in the repair process and says, if you're going to write an estimate, you have to give it to the claimant. Now, that's a claims regulation. What Farmers did in this case, and there was some discussion about this, but I'd like it to be clear. What Farmers did in this case is go around Mr. Dillon. The written estimate went to the shop only.
Was there an oral discussion?
On the record, there was an oral discussion.
Between whom?
Between the adjuster and Mr. Dillon.
So really, the insurance company didn't have to put a written estimate in the mail, did they?
The B2 section, the oral discussion section, says if you're going to do this, you must read this disclosure about the warranties, for example. You have to read what's in B1. There is nothing on the record indicating the first step towards compliance with that statute.
Counsel,
okay,
I want to make
so
sure.
Then you're saying that that requires then, because there was no compliance with the actual reading to the customer over the telephone, that requires the written estimate to be given to the consumer.
The statute provides some alternatives. Neither one was followed.
Okay, are you saying, answer the question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand.
Well, there wasn't, you could have said that.
Yeah, I should
have answered something you thought I asked. You're telling me that the first part was never complied with. Nobody picked up the telephone, said, Mr. Dillon, let me read this paragraph to you. You're saying that never happened?
Correct.
Undisputed?
Undisputed.
Okay, so then that triggered the obligation to supply a written estimate, correct?
I understand the question now. I wouldn't characterize the statute that way. I don't think that it's... if you elect not to do this reading over the telephone, then
no
you must provide
a writing. So there's no roadmap there for the insurance company, what you need to do next.
Right. I read the statute to say whichever way you do it, you have to get this language in front of the claimant.
Okay. And does it say that the insurance company must hand that document directly to the insured?
Yes. And there's a...
Where does that say that?
Well...
It doesn't. It doesn't say must hand to.
It does say that you must solicit both receipt and approval from the consumer.
That's not what the chief asked you. Is there anything in the statute saying you must hand this to the injured driver?
I'm not sure how one would get to approval without actually...
Well, you give it to the body shop, which is what they did here. And the guy said, Mr. Dillon, you know, from the mission, I've got this estimate. I'd like to go over it with you. And where did you get that auto body? He said, I got that from, you know, Farmers Insurance.
Right.
Why is that not sufficient? And why is that contrary to the statute?
The statute provides a couple of alternatives. One is get it signed. The other is make sure that this is read to Mr. Dillon. And there's no evidence of compliance with either one.
There is no dispute that Mr. Dillon saw the written estimate from the auto body shop.
He did not see it before...
Before he decided to go with original parts only?
He did see the written estimate, yes.
Okay, yes. And he had already by that time made up his mind that I don't care what the written estimate is, I'm going with original parts.
The statute is designed to put the insurance company into that discussion about what parts are going to be used at the time that decision is being made. You're right, it's not explicitly in there. I'm not sure how you would involve the insurance company without a substantial compliance test here is not what's intended by the statute and would vitiate the purposes of the statute.
Well, counsel, you are the appellee here, and I assume that you agree with the Fifth District Court of Appeals that this is a consumer transaction between the insurance company and their insured.
Well, Your Honor, I agree with the Fifth District Court of Appeals. I would approach the analysis of this differently. I don't think that the court needs to approach the issue of whether this is a consumer transaction between the insurance company and the insured. It's definitely a consumer transaction between the insured and the shop in which the insurance company involves itself. And the statute says when you're going to involve yourself in this particular transaction, these are the particular things that you must do.
Was Mr. Dillon's car owned by him or leased?
I believe it was owned by him, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, you use your time. You may take a minute.
Mr. Dillon received a copy of the estimate in the mail. We know that because he said that on page 35 of his deposition.
Okay, so he received a copy in the mail to his address.
Yes.
So this discussion we just had with opposing counsel that he only saw it through Mission Auto is not correct.
Correct. On page 35 of Mr. Dillon's deposition, he said he received it in the mail.
And I'm presuming that, all right, maybe this isn't in the record. Who took it to Mission Auto Repair? Was it also submitted to Mission?
Yes, by the adjuster. Whether he handed it to them on the spot or mailed it,
okay,
but it should be in the deposition.
It's off the table of whether or not how Mr. Dillon received this document.
Correct.
And it had the boilerplate that's required under B1?
Correct. The purpose of the statute is full disclosure so the consumer knows what they're getting, what they're not getting, so they can make a conscious and informed choice. When you look at Mr. Dillon's deposition, he made it very clear that he knew even before he discussed this with Mr. Babb or before he had any discussions with the auto body shop, he knew the difference between OEM and aftermarket parts. He wanted OEM. He made an informed and conscious choice here.
Counsel, let's assume for the moment that we disagree with you about whether there was a violation and we find that there was a violation. Can you address subsection E? Your friends on the other side talk about the in connection with language. Why was this not in connection with a consumer transaction between the consumer and the repair facility?
I'll answer it in two steps. Any interaction between Mr. Dillon and Farmers is not a consumer transaction.
Okay.
As it relates to Mr. Dillon and the body shop, the reason it's still not in connection with a consumer transaction is because Farmers was not controlling any aspect of the repair.
Does that matter if the statute says in connection with?
I think it would be a very different scenario if, for example, Farmers said to Mr. Dillon, you must go to Mission. Here we know, though, Mr. Dillon chose the body shop on his own because he had a past relationship. It would be a different story if Farmers mandated to the body shop, this is what you're going to do, this is how you're going to do it, these are the parts you're going to use, this is where you're going to get them from,
well, and micromanage the process. What about the process. Argument this morning that Farmers pretty much did say, this is all we're going to pay for, and by the way, Mission Auto, you can get these parts at this warehouse or this source?
Mission Auto was free to get whatever parts they felt were needed.
They didn't dictate that. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. You know, for example, if Mission Auto Parts, if Mission Auto Repair decided to get the parts from Plant B and not Plant A, that wouldn't put Farmers in a position where they can say, okay, we're not paying the claim now because you didn't get them from where we asked for. It was a suggestion. Farmers was not dictating or controlling any aspect of
so
what the shop
did. So you're
saying
the only involvement that Farmers had in this consumer transaction between Mr. Dillon and the repair shop is to supply what in essence is, here's our bottom line and what we're going to pay for, and this is pursuant to our insurance agreement.
Correct. And that bottom line number was in full compliance with the insurance policy, and even the Fifth District agreed.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, gentlemen. You'll be notified of our decision.